New York citizens for Kennedy and Johnson present a transcribed rebroadcast of a major foreign policy address made last night by the Honorable Adlai E. Stevenson. In the grand ballroom of the Commodore Hotel, Governor Stevenson was introduced by Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt.
It is my great privilege tonight to introduce, not only to the audience here, but to the vast radio audience, our speaker of the evening, who will speak on foreign affairs. I'm very happy to have this privilege because I've had not only a deep affection, but a very deep admiration for our speaker for a number of years. He has served his country with great unselfishness. And I think every one of us as citizens owes him a debt of gratitude. And so I give you tonight, with great pride, one of America's greatest citizens, Adlai E. Stevenson.
Mrs. Roosevelt, Senator Lehman, Mayor Wagner, Mrs. Tree, Mr. Buttonweiser, my dear friends. I don't suppose any greater honor can befall anyone than to be introduced by Mrs. Roosevelt at all, let alone to be introduced so charitably as she has introduced me this evening. Since I was last here in New York, a month ago, I have traveled from coast to coast on behalf of the Kennedy-Johnson ticket. And I have seen again the might, the majesty, the magnificent panorama of our beautiful country. It brought back to me vivid memories of my campaign travels in 1952 and 1956, when I was the Democratic candidate for president. And it also brought back to me something of the exhilaration and also the frustration of those campaigns. Everywhere I went, I met multitudes of friends who asked me how it felt to be campaigning for someone else. And I said I felt that that's what I'd been doing for the past 8 years. In the 1952 campaign, during the Korean War and after 20 years of Democratic administrations, General Eisenhower called for a change, and he won. In the 1956 campaign, when employment was high and there was no war, he called for no change, and he won. In those campaigns, the people didn't seem to care to hear about the violent revolutions that were dramatically, rapidly changing the world all about us. President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon said everything was fine, to relax and enjoy it. And the people did just that. Now it is different. The meeting of the United Nations in New York has been only the latest spectacular example of the way in which world politics has become local politics. And it also provides a somber warning, a warning that the road to peace, that goal so long cherished by all mankind, is hard, perilous, and painful. Now people everywhere are anxious and uncertain, and they are asking questions. What is the true significance of the hostile riots in South America, in Tokyo, of the collapse of the summit conference in Paris, of our blunders over the U2 incident, of communism in Cuba, of rifts in our alliance, of the chilliness of the new members of the United Nations? Why is our economy stagnant? Is another recession already imminent? What does Khrushchev's brutal behavior and domination of the General Assembly mean? Are we losing our following in the United Nations? What is happening to our so-called positions of strength around the world? Why does Vice President Nixon say everything is fine, but don't change governments in such perilous times? And why does Senator Kennedy say everything is not fine, and that we must change governments before things get worse? I say that people are troubled, that they want the truth about our situation at last. And above all, they want peace on earth. The farmer wants better prices, of course, but he wants peace more. The housewife wants lower prices, of course, but she wants peace more. The worker wants higher wages. The businessman wants better profits, but they want peace more. Everybody wants lower taxes, of course, but they want peace more. Unless we know the truth about our situation, unless we know where we are, we cannot know where to go or how to get there. Senator Kennedy has been trying patiently to tell us where we are, that we have been misled and deceived for years, that the power balance in the world has been changing while we have been sleeping, that our invulnerable post-war position has vanished, that the political influence of the Soviet Union has been rapidly expanding, that their military inferiority has been erased, that our foreign policy has not kept pace with the changes, and that confidence in our judgment and in our leadership has declined, and with it, our influence in the world. Mr. Nixon and Mr. Lodge disagree and say that to talk that way is unpatriotic and dangerous, that it downgrades America, that it gives aid and comfort to the enemy. What's more, they say it isn't true, and America has never been stronger and our prestige in the world never higher. And they even cite the overwhelming vote of approval of Secretary General Hammarskjöld in the United Nations as illustrating our prestige. But I think I have news for Mr. Lodge and Mr. Nixon that that was not a vote of confidence in Republican foreign policy. It was a vote of confidence in Mr. Hammarskjöld's policy in the Belgian Congo. And I say that to silence debate with lullabies and irrelevancies is to smother democracy. I say that not suppression or innuendo or accusation, but only sober, serious discussion of our predicament can ever reveal the facts and produce the new directions that we need so badly. We were told 2,000 years ago that the truth would make us free. It has. Today, the truth is arbiter not only between freedom and tyranny, but between life and death. The world, a revered clergyman said, has become too dangerous for anything but the truth. No one then will lightly charge another with keeping from America the truth upon which its freedom and its future depends. But let me read a little from the record. In 1952 and 1953, the country was given to understand that the enslaved countries of Eastern Europe could somehow be liberated by electing a Republican administration, and that China would be freed by unleashing Chiang Kai-shek. That was not true. In 1954, Mr. Nixon charged me with spreading pro-communist propaganda when I warned about Russia's rapid economic growth. That was not true. And 4 years later, Mr. Nixon was solemnly making identical statements about Russia's rapid economic growth. By 1955, the leading journalistic fraternity reported that there has developed today the worst abridgment of the Americans' right to know about the federal government in our history. In 1955, the Republican candidate returned from Latin America to report that communism has reached and fortunately passed, to quote his words, its high watermark in the inter-American area. 4 years later, after Castro's revolution, the vice president was assuring an American audience that, and I quote him, the Cuban people themselves will not tolerate a communist government or a communist takeover. In 1956, the vice president denounced our proposal that America take the lead toward nuclear arms control and stopping the hydrogen bomb tests as catastrophic nonsense and a theatrical gesture. 2 years later, the United States took this identical step, following Russia's leadership, with Mr. Nixon's approval. Again, during the campaign of 1956, the president announced that he had good news from Suez, that he knew of no disagreements with our European allies, that Secretary Dulles had assured him that everything was fine. By the end of the month, there was war in the Middle East, and our alliance was split wide open. In 1957, the Republican candidate told a Chicago audience that last year's uprising in Hungary and Poland marked the beginning of an internal revolt that will ultimately sweep the communist empire away. This was on a par with Secretary Dulles' solemn declaration that year that the Soviet Union was on the point of collapsing. In 1958, the administration and Mr. Nixon were assuring the nation that our military position had not worsened in comparison with Russia. But the Rockefeller Report stated that, and I quote them, the United States is rapidly losing its lead over the USSR in the military race. And so did the Gaither Report, which the president ordered and then suppressed. In 1959, the same panel of experts summed it all up by these words. The United States has been jolting along from crisis to crisis, viewing foreign policy as a rather unpleasant device for warding off threats all over the world. Yet Mr. Nixon was still saying that all was well, and he still is. And he is now a candidate for President of the United States in one of the most critical intervals of human history. I don't know whether such misleading statements are the product of ignorance or of deceit or both, but they are not all. The vice president now tells us that in such times we need someone cool and cautious at the controls, someone with experience and with understanding. Well, let's have a quick look at that. On the evening of May 15th of this year, Mr. Nixon solemnly said that we would have to keep on sending spy planes over the Soviet Union. The next day, the president announced that the flights had been canceled 4 days earlier. In April 1954, Mr. Nixon said, we must take the risk of now of putting American boys into the fighting in Indochina. Fortunately, his position was disavowed by the administration a few days later. In 1956, at the height of that unhappy Suez crisis, Mr. Nixon hailed the break with Britain and France, our oldest allies, as a declaration of independence that has had an electrifying effect throughout the world, he said. 2 years later, he was in England proclaiming the indissoluble partnership of Britain and America in war and peace. In South America, he disregarded sober advice and pushed into hostile crowds, evidently indifferent to the fact that he was exposing to violence and insult, not just himself, but the United States, which he represented. And now he has lightly thrown away the diplomatic flexibility of this country by committing the United States to the defense of Quemoy and Matsu, not just to the defense of Formosa, but of Quemoy and Matsu too. And he has even self-righteously criticized Senator Kennedy for sticking strictly to our treaty commitments to defend Formosa, a commitment, by the way, made by the Eisenhower-Nixon administration. Is it any wonder that Mr. Nixon's impetuosity is viewed with alarm by so many people, both at home and abroad? And yesterday he accused me of, as he put it, favoring a deal with the communist Chinese, which would have us trade for a worthless guarantee of freedom for Formosa, American support for admission to the United Nations. This is yet another example of Mr. Nixon's recklessness. I have never proposed American support for admission of Red China. What I did suggest is that we must re-examine our China policy, that the important thing is not the little islands of Kaimoi and Matsu. The important thing is the security and independence of Formosa. And I repeat today, what I said 5 years ago. If Red China agrees to recognize the independence of Formosa and to renounce the use of force against its neighbors, we should no longer lead the fight to keep Red China out of the United Nations. But evidently, Mr. Nixon doesn't want any friends, and he thinks that any broader guarantee of the security of Formosa is worthless. I disagree. Let me make one thing clear. Our indictment of the Eisenhower-Nixon administration is not for a lack of loyalty, but for a lack of candor. It is not for an absence of good intentions, but rather for a failure of foresight. We do not charge that the administration is responsible for all of our difficulties in this revolutionary epoch, but we do hold it responsible for not telling the whole truth, for failing to anticipate the tides of change, for never moving with enough speed, with enough imagination, enough generosity of spirit to conquer manageable problems before they become unmanageable crises. Speaking of crises, Mr. Nixon said here in New York, what you need in dealing with communist leaders is in knowing what it takes to act in a crisis. And you get that way by being in a crisis. Well, if I understand that curious syntax, I hope things aren't getting contagious in Washington. His proposition is apparently that in times of crisis, we should choose a man experienced in creating crisis. Senator Kennedy has patiently, day after day, faced the stern, the unpleasant, the unpopular realities of our time, while his opponent has been trying to silence criticism and discussion. Well, I can see why. The vice president would prefer not to discuss our situation after 8 years of Republican leadership. But it is a repelling thought that we would countenance at the center of our government the view that to ask questions is unpatriotic, to criticize is un-American, to doubt is heresy, and to oppose is treason. But no more repellent than his typical tactic of charging the Democratic Party with leading us to war. Would Mr. Nixon not have fought back after Pearl Harbor? Would he not have defended South Korea against communist aggression? It sounds rather to me as though Mr. Nixon had begun playing checkers with us again. And so I say to Mr. Nixon and Mr. Lodge, let us tell the truth to the American people. And let us stop this dangerous talk about anybody's being weak and disloyal or soft-headed if he talks about peace by any other means than your massive retaliation or your futile finger-waggling in Khrushchev's face. Let's stop kidding the people that they've never had it so good. Our paramount duty, Republicans and Democrats alike, is to face honestly the facts about the world, the warm, the heartening truth about what we have done, and the cold, the chilling truth about what we have not done and must do. And let's face the facts now. It won't be easy. The other day I read about those Republican truth squads. that follow the candidates around. I remember they followed me around, and I said somewhere that they bore, those truth squads bore the same relation to the truth that the fire department does to the fire. They'll put it out if they can. We must get in quickly to that point where we can effectively and safely challenge the Russians not to an armament race, but to a disarmament race. I don't mean a unilateral disarmament race. I mean a controlled, planned, inspected disarmament to make it safe for both of us, and the world a safer place for us all to live in. The other day I read a speech that I gave in Chicago exactly 20 years ago tonight about facing the facts of life in those days, in that period of conflicting opinion about America's part in the war. I say tonight what I said then. We are witnessing a death struggle, I said, between our traditions and pagan traditions. It is only as we believe that the Western tradition is worth preserving at any price that we will, as a nation, have the counter-dynamic required to meet and defeat the totalitarian outthrust. That time, Hitler and Mussolini drew the sword, and they died by the sword. This time, we must find a way to defeat the outthrust without war. We must attack war itself, and until we do, peace can remain only an armed truce, an uneasy and explosive interlude between agonies of destruction. Peace will not come from our wishing, our hoping. We must help our prayers. Peace will not come by default from the weakness of communism. If we can't bestir ourselves, if we don't take the leadership that is ours, if we are unwilling to pay the price in terms of money and vision and conviction, then there will be no peace. The imperative of peace is strength. Strength means many things. It means military strength. It means economic strength. It means political strength, the strength of will and of decision. It means moral purpose, the strength of purpose and of ideals. In these last 7 years, we have lost ground in every dimension of strength. We have fallen behind in the rate of industrial growth. We have fallen behind in the contest for space. We have fallen behind in technical education. We have fallen behind. We have failed to keep pace with the terrible revolutions in weapons and in technology. We have lost ground in performance, and we have lost ground in influence. Meanwhile, Russian influence has penetrated the Middle East. Our so-called positions of strength in Asia, in South Korea, in Japan, in Turkey, in Iran, in Laos, in Vietnam, have been eroded one by one. Because we had no constructive common policy for Africa, communist influence is now actively at work there. In Latin America, we courted dictators, neglected the people, and woke up only this summer after Castro. 8 years ago, the Cold War, like the hot wars in Indochina and in Korea, was far, far away. Meanwhile, it has swept ever closer until communist influence is now consolidating its power in Cuba, a few miles from our shore. Mr. Nixon has said repeatedly that militarily, economically, diplomatically, we are in a position of strength unparalleled in the history of this country. Any man who believes this will believe anything. He'll believe anything and he'll do nothing. We heard his foreign policy program just the other night. He plans to call conferences to see what ought to be done, if anything. Now, this has been the pattern of deferred decision of the past 8 years. When in doubt, call a conference and pass the buck. I was reminded of that little verse, fact-finding committees, commissions, and such are wonderful, who would displace them? But the White House would add a delightful new touch if, having found facts, it would face them. Senator Kennedy on the contrary, has made the question of our national power and influence the central issue of his campaign. For years, he has warned of the relative decline of American position as new centers of influence arise in the world. For years, he has called attention to what the United States must do to recover its strength and its leadership. And Mr. Nixon, to the contrary, notwithstanding, the man who loves his country best is precisely the man who will hold it to its highest standards. So as I see it, this is the choice in this campaign, whether to drift along in a soft sea of self-congratulation, telling ourselves that each new disaster is a new victory, or whether we wake up, whether we come to life again, and resume the pattern of national greatness and of international responsibility. The path of Woodrow Wilson, the path of Franklin Roosevelt, the path of John F. Kennedy. Our success, my friends, depends on the economic, the political, the social health of the United States. It depends on our wisdom and on our patience. It depends on how well we can make democracy work and private enterprise work. Paralysis and impotence would rob us of our chance. Inflation, boom, and bust would be disastrous. We cannot enlist the allegiance of the masses of the world under freedom's shining banner when it is soiled with racial intolerance and economic discrimination. The world today has no place for an America that is tired, timid, unwilling to take the initiative history has thrust upon us. The world cries out for an America born in revolution to wake once more to demands no less than those we answered 2 centuries ago, to throw off these encircling chains of a new tyranny, to raise once more the standard of freedom, to take once again the leadership for liberty. Because again, the other choice is death. But let us do it this time, not with war, but in peace. Let it be asked which of our two parties will drive harder for peace. And let it be asked which can best stop the declining respect and influence in the world of the United States. Those that started it, or those that have warned against it for years. I say that this election is a choice between hard truth and careless fancy, between daring and disaster, between those who really care and those who just want to win. And that choice is clear on the record. It is John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and the Democratic Party.
Give all you can afford and a little more to help spread the message of 1960. Invest in the future of America by sending Dollars for Democracy to New York Citizens for Kennedy and Johnson, 277 Park Avenue, New York 17. This rebroadcast of Governor Stevenson's address was presented on tape by New York Citizens for Kennedy and Johnson and was produced by Robert M. Marks and Company, Walter McGraw speaking.